Everyone, welcome to the Villa Together podcast with myself, Chris Ellis. And today I'm joined by a very special guest, which is Mr. David Reed of Sky Sports. David, how are we doing?
All right, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Nice one. Thanks for coming on. We just had a quick chat, just kind of explaining. It's nice to get people on to kind of find out the origins of why they support Aston Villa, bit of nostalgia, memories and stuff like that. And obviously, people who are well known to the football community. So, how long have you been an Aston Villa fan for, and kind of, you know, your reasons behind supporting the club?
Well, at first, it feels a little bit weird for me to be answering questions because it's usually me doing the asking, to be honest. I've been a Villa supporter all my life, really, born and brought up in the area. In Solihull, and it's been quite difficult really in my household growing up, because my dad is from Coventry. He supports Coventry City, and you know, that was really where the love of football came from my dad. And despite, he made me sit down and watch reruns of the 1987 FA Cup final where Coventry beat Spurs. I had to sit there, you know, on quite a few Sundays to watch that with him. And it never quite got through to me, the Coventry City thing at all. I remember my earliest memory really was watching local news, and the sport came on and they mentioned this team called Aston Villa. And I must have been maybe 5 or 6. I remember looking up at the TV going, well, that's an interesting name, a different name for a team. I think I'll start to follow them. And then as I went through primary school, really, 7, 8 years old, I really started to get involved. I remember I had the poster on my wall from the 94 Coca-Cola Cup win. You know, I could name that team off by heart from at one stage, because it was just, that was the iconic moment for me growing up. And even my dad didn't quite give up, because the first ever game of football that I went to was at Highfield Road. It was Dave Booth's testimonial. Dave Booth was a player who suffered a really bad injury, was forced to retire because of it. And they organised a testimonial against Manchester United. And there were some unbelievable names there. I think it was Eric Cantona's last game for Manchester United before he retired. And then Paul Gascoigne played. And then all the Coventry players from the 90s, you know, and Manchester United players as well, you know, the Beckham, you know, that sort of era of Manchester United players. And although being starstruck by a lot of those Manchester United players at that age, it still managed to really come through to me to be an Aston Villa supporter. And that's where it sort of started and carried on from, really.
Yeah, it's funny you talk about Manchester United. When I was younger, my mum and dad, my dad is from Birmingham. Luckily, he's from the heart of Birmingham. Luckily, he's not a football fan. If he was, he'd support Birmingham. Luckily, he's not. So I chose Aston Villa. But when I was younger, and they'd buy me tickets, they always used to pick Man United and, you know, Chelsea, Arsenal, stuff like that. And Man United would always beat us. They still do, always have done. I'd go to the games and we'd lose. And I'd kind of say, why do I always go see Man United? Well, I thought you'd want to go and see the big players. And it's like, okay, it is good. You know, I like seeing David Beckham and stuff like that. But at the same time, I want to see Aston Villa win. But I think it's one of them. That's just football in general, isn't it? You support a club through, you know, thick and thin, as they say. And, you know, it's a big part of it. You go to games and you see these amazing players or come up against your team and all this kind of stuff. From growing up supporting the club, what's your kind of your earliest memory or maybe your fondest memory growing up supporting Aston Villa?
Oh, I mean, there's loads. I remember reenacting the Phil King winning penalty against Inter Milan in my front room, like just with balloons and stuff, kicking it around in the lounge. I used to commentate to myself. You know, my first Villa game was actually just, you know, just going back to your earlier point there, was at it was at Highfield Road, and it was Coventry against Aston Villa. I remember my dad saying before we went, he was like, you know, you can't celebrate. You know, you've got to sit on your hands, you know. And I was thinking, really? You know, don't, you know, football's not like that anymore. Anyway, I soon realised when I got in there that I was definitely not going to celebrate. And I even had to stand up and clap for when I think it was Mustafa Hadji scored an equaliser in that game. Obviously, then had a tale to tell for us as well. And those were really my earliest memories. I remember the semi-final of the Coca-Cola Cup, the Bosnich save against Tranmere in a penalty shootout. And Bosnich was really my hero growing up. That was the first Villa kit. It was the multicoloured Muller goalkeeper shirt. That was the first kit that I had. And it was Bosnich really that made me want to be a goalkeeper when I was younger as well. And he was my inspiration. Never made it, obviously. But he was my inspiration to start out being a goalkeeper.
Yeah, I mean, what a character. And obviously, what a goalkeeper. It's funny, a lot of people kind of similar age, you talk to them and they talk about those memories from Coca-Cola Cup 94, 96 as well. And they mentioned Mark Bosnich. And we spoke to Sean Teal a number of weeks ago for the podcast. And he was telling us about when they went down to London for the Coca-Cola Cup final and they kind of got there and then they had to go training. And they're training and they're kind of making sure they don't get injured. And a cross comes in and Sean Teal's there to go and attack the header. And Mark Bosnich comes flying out with a fist, punches Sean Teal in the nose and breaks his nose. And, that was typical of Mark Bosnich. And he said the funny thing was that he got away with it in terms of thought he looked all right. And he got to, they were walking around Wembley before the game and the Man United boys were laughing at him because of the way his nose looked and he was all swollen. But yeah, I mean, Mark Bosnich wore some interesting tops, didn't he, during his time at Aston Villa. they're classics, and it's one of those things that's kind of almost coming back now, isn't it? People love the classic shirts and all that kind of stuff, and Mark Bosnich certainly wore a few of them, didn't he? What about kind of the players that you watched growing up? I mean, there's obviously loads, especially during the 90s, quality players. You know, in terms of like a favourite player that you might have enjoyed watching growing up?
Yeah, there's no doubt really. It's Paul Merson for me. He was my favourite player growing up. And I was lucky enough and random enough to meet him when it was my birthday. And I don't know if anybody knows, like Solihull, there used to be a retail park in Solihull, a big cinema, and there used to be this arcade place called Dave and Buster's. And I went there for my birthday and you could pay your entrance fee and you could go on all the different arcade games. And I was wandering around, wondering what game I was going to go on next. And sat there in one of the booths was Paul Merson and Ian Taylor with their families. And I saw them and ran straight away from them back to my mom and dad. I was like, you'll never guess who's around there. And they were like, oh, you've got to go and get your autograph. And I was super shy at that point. But I managed to pluck up the courage and went over and asked for their autographs, and they were both absolutely brilliant. I'm not kind of sure of the timeline of where Paul Merson was in his life at that point, but and indeed why him and Ian Taylor were in there, it doesn't really tell you. Maybe they're just on a date with a family, which is absolutely fine, obviously. But yeah, it was all a bit strange to see them in there. But yeah, no doubt about it, Paul Merson for me was just, he was brilliant. The way he conducted that midfield and the skill and the class. And he was one of those players that raised the level of others around him when he played. And he was just absolutely brilliant, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, we've spoke about a number of times about players that came to the club who potentially were past it when they came to us. And obviously, Merce coming to us, big reputation. I think at the time when we signed him, people thought, well, maybe he's past it. But he was brilliant. He was fantastic. I remember the FA Cup game against Leeds when we came back from 2-0 down. I think Carboni got a hat-trick. Merson was instrumental in that game and he got a kick to the face, didn't he? Setting up one of the goals. Yeah. But yeah, he was phenomenal. And in terms of, kind of talent that we had at the club, he was certainly up there, one of the best players. Obviously, we've kind of had, over the years, we had, I suppose, during the 90s, there was obviously the kind of Coca-Cola Cup wins. And we had the team under, I suppose, John Gregory coming into the 2000s. Then I suppose we had the kind of team under O'Neill that was challenging top six. After that, it went a bit downhill and we seem to be on the up now. When you kind of think of the teams over the years that you will have watched, what kind of era do you think you've enjoyed watching the most?
That's a great question. That is a great question. I would say the eras that we've spoken about so far, I was probably a little bit too young to appreciate it. The victories in the League Cup and the UEFA Cup runs, I was probably a little bit too young to appreciate the players and the way we played football. So I would probably say the Martin O'Neill era was the era that I've enjoyed, just because everything seemed to click at times. And, you know, we were obviously challenging for that Champions League place and ended up falling away on a couple of occasions. But it was all of those attacking players really that fitted in, and they were absolutely brilliant. And a player who kind of spanned that era for me was Olaf Melberg, and he's another player who I absolutely love, and along with Paul Merson, really, is one of my favourite players of all time, of my time anyway, watching Aston Villa. He was just absolutely brilliant at the back. And then having all those players in midfield as well, Ashley Young, James Milner, Gareth Barry in his prime as well, that was just fantastic football. It coincided with my years at university as well. So, we, you know, it was some great nights out, really, after Villa victories, and, you know, going to watch them more often. And it was a time where I could really enjoy being an Aston Villa fan at that point.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people of a particular age who would have seen and appreciated that team, I think those years were great. I think probably there's that kind of bitter taste in the mouth over O'Neill leaving and how close we were to top four. I think as well the way we kind of almost fell off going, you know, the 4 or 5 years treading water at the bottom of the league and then getting relegated. But certainly the attacking talent we had then, the pace going forward, it's over the last 10, 15 years maybe, pace going forward is like kind of almost been the epitome of the Premier League, hasn't it, in terms of those exciting teams. We had those players in abundance, you know, Gabby, John Carew, Ashley Young, James Milner, Stuart Downing. They were all fantastic. So I think there's a hell of a lot of people who enjoyed that. Moving forward to now, obviously, we seem to be, I say, turning a corner. Maybe we turn that corner with, I suppose, post-lockdown, the first time round, going from last the back end of last season, when it looked like we're going to go down. We stayed up on the last day, and then we've had a great start to this season. What are your kind of thoughts of how the team's shaping up under Dean Smith, John Terry, Richard O'Kelly, and kind of how our form's been this season?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was wondering actually at the start of this season how Dean would approach it, because obviously post-lockdown, we were very much 11 men behind the ball, defensive. And that really is against the nature, I'd say, of Dean Smith. He's a naturally attacking coach, and we've seen that throughout his career. So I thought it'd be interesting as to how he started this year with the balance of trying to keep that solidity that managed to keep us up at the end of last season, but then also trying to balance that out with attacking intent, because we'd have to go out and collect points. It wasn't just a case of a 10-game shootout, as Dean called it, to stay in the Premier League this time round. It's a full season. Coupled with greater expectation this time around with everything that happened in the January in the summer transfer window, I thought it'd be really interesting to find out how he started this season. And as we've seen, really, it's been great to watch on the most part. I think you would expect defeats along the way. I don't think many Villa fans would have expected the start that we've had. And I know going into the game at Arsenal over the weekend, last weekend, that, you know, perhaps we wouldn't have expected to get that result given the previous two results that we'd had in the Premier League. But it's been exciting to watch. I think the team has developed. I think the team has grown. And I think, you know, when it comes to signings, we had one of the better transfer windows in the summer, because the signings that we brought in have improved that starting 11. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And with the expectations that Villa will have this year, you know, at this point in time, you would be looking at a mid-table finish this season. But, you know, it's a case of this is going to be a mad year, isn't it? You know, it's going to be very difficult to predict for anybody who's going to finish where. But I think already at the bottom of the table, you're perhaps starting to see that the teams that will be fighting against relegation, and you just think and hope now that Villa aren't going to be in amongst that.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the kind of main thing for me. And we spoke about it after the game on Sunday, looking at, I suppose, the foundation we've built so far in terms of the 15 points we've got is massive in terms of staying up, which is still going to be start of the season. That was obviously the aim. Stay up, 17th is the aim. Anything better than 17th, that is progression from last season, which is what you want. But then you look at that coupled with the teams down the bottom and the lack of points down there. And there's also a gap opening up from, I think, the bottom four teams, that even with a win, I think possibly the Fulham win still can't move them up one place. Those kind of gaps opening up at the bottom and then just above them, and obviously with us being up there, that's just given us that platform to hopefully get a few more points before the end of the year, 2020, so that we can kind of not necessarily relax, but I suppose play with a bit more freedom going into 2021, the kind of second part of the season. But it's certainly been we've built well from the back, which I imagine, you know, all the guys, ex-defenders, have helped with that. But as well, we are kind of playing the football that I think we probably hoped to see and maybe expected to see under Dean Smith. But certainly the point you made about expecting defeat, certainly when you look at those, the fixtures we had the first, obviously, seven games or whatever, you looked at them and I think it would have been difficult to pick out kind of games you might have expected to have got points from. And ironically, you may have looked at it and said, Southampton, Leeds, maybe we'll get points there, but a lot of the other games we might not. But then, you know, we haven't got points against those two, but then all the other games we have done, obviously, wins against Leicester, Liverpool and Arsenal have been fantastic. A lot of people have kind of asked me the question, have kind of posed it and stuff. Do you think that with everything going on at the moment and there being no fans, do you think that kind of, not just with Aston Villa, but do you think not having the fans has kind of maybe eased things on the pitch slightly for the players in terms of that the fans sometimes don't get on the back of players?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that, to be honest. I think the pace of the game is a little bit slower, and I think that's helped someone like Douglas Luiz, certainly post-lockdown. He's been one of our best outstanding performers. I think the pace of the game has just slightly dropped off a little bit, and that's helped him. And in going into the start of this season, I think he's, again, proved to be one of our best performers. I don't think there's any doubt. I think if you look at it from a manager's perspective, you know, they'll be going into every game saying, ignore the crowd, play your game. But I think it's very hard as a player because the crowd influences a lot of decisions that you make on the pitch, particularly at home. And, you know, we've seen with teams like Arsenal, if they make mistakes playing the ball out from the back, if there was a full, Emirates Stadium there, there would be moans and groans, and that may affect decision-making on the pitch. So I think there is a strong argument definitely to say that the game without fans makes it slightly easier for players to maybe concentrate for the full 90 minutes and certainly carry out the manager's plans. You know, there's no excuse for the fullback on the opposite side of the pitch not to hear the manager anymore. So I think there's definitely an element of the game without fans that players are definitely able to play their game a little bit more than perhaps they would do with supporters in.
I think a good point that you make about decision making, and I know they're professional footballers and they get paid a hell of a lot of money. I think sometimes not necessarily the shouts from the crowd, but the atmosphere that the crowd can generate sometimes might make a player rush a decision a bit more when they've got the ball, where they decide just to lump it in the box or to have a shot, where not having that allows them to maybe take a couple of seconds and make the right decision. I feel like, especially obviously watching Aston Villa week in, week out, that possibly has helped us in particular. Just touching on the current COVID situation, you spoke to an ex-Aston Villa player, Issa Suleiman, the back end of last season, about coronavirus and obviously testing and all that kind of stuff. And it was interesting to see how, even though he would So you know, he gets a notification about going to a test, and he'd go to a test and he's got no symptoms and all that kind of stuff. He would still be nervous going to get tested. Does it still kind of surprise you that football from Premier League, obviously in this country, Premier League down to League Two, is still going on, even though the players are having to get tested so often, and kind of there's that mental element they have to put themselves through before tests every so often? Does that kind of surprise you slightly that all that is still going on? Not in terms of we haven't stopped stuff, but we kind of put all the players through that, and it's almost like we put the footballer of them before we do as that person.
Yeah, it's a good point you make. It's a good point you make. I spoke to Issa. It was right at the start of when leagues were starting to go back, and he's playing out in Portugal. For anybody who's not sure where he is at the minute, and he's doing really well actually. He's getting, you know, regular minutes out there in Portugal at the moment in the top division for a good stable European pushing team as well. But it was right at the start of when players were going back to training and having to go through the protocol. So I think there was a little bit of nervousness around that anyway, just because it was a bit of, well, it was unknown territory for players to be going back into that situation and having to be tested. The Premier League players are getting tested twice a week. I think as time has gone on, that process has become a little bit easier. They know where they need to be at what time. They know what day the testers are coming. They know everything that they need to know about the process of what's happening. But I don't think there's any doubt that there would be, you know, there is a mental toll on the players, because their secure bubbles are at the training ground and family at home if they live with other family members. So, you know, I don't think we can underplay really the extent as to how difficult it is for players to be playing twice a week, but then also not being able to do much else. Now, I know a lot of us are in that situation anyway, and a lot of people are still having to go to work. And in the grand scheme of things, you know, there's much more important people having to go through all sorts at work at the moment to help keep the country going. So I think that the football, it was something that was realised by the government straight away, that with not a lot happening in the country, people needed something to look forward to, something to watch. And I think football plays that role in our society. It's a huge part of our society. And I think it was recognised quite early on by the government that if there was a possibility of getting football back on, then I think they would go to all the lengths in order to do it. Now, there's other elements to this argument as well about Premier League having to, you know, if it was curtailed or if the season was ended, they would have to give a financial rebate to clubs, to broadcasters. You know, there was obviously financial aspects involved in that. But from, you know, a simple person point of view and a people point of view, there was that eagerness to get football back on. And I think the players, that, you know, they want to play, they don't want to be stuck at home and not playing. So you have to think about that as well. You know, there was a time, you know, and we heard Troy Deeney talking about it as well, you know, that there was potential that he would refuse to play. And when Villa were coming back into training, you know, Dean Smith was saying that there were a number of players with family members who were in the, you know, the shielding category, and that would make things difficult for them. So there are individual situations for each player, but I think the majority would say that they would want to be playing. And I think that was part of the decision as well to get football back on.
I suppose in the kind of same way as people like us and everyone else, it's kind of becoming the new norm at the moment. So, you know, when I go to the shop, I'm to put a mask on and things like that. Make sure you're washing your hands and sanitising, that kind of stuff. I think for footballers, when it comes to, obviously, there's those kind of things they have to do as well. But when going to training, when going to games, there's things that they now have to do that they're going to have done for, you know, the best part of 6 months. And also the kind of testing side of things that they are used to now. It is becoming the new norm, as kind of, as bad as that is, it is the new norm. So obviously, it is something that they will be getting used to, or potentially may have already got used to. But I suppose the big part of that will be, as you've touched on, about I think people's family situations as well kind of make things, you know, slightly more difficult depending on, you know, who they live with and who they can and can't see. But certainly I think that is something that's happening moving forward, the it becoming the new norm. Just want to touch on about obviously your career, Sky Sports. How did you kind of get into doing journalism? Was it obviously you went to university? Was that something at a, you know, when you were at school that you knew you wanted to go into, or was that a case of you going through college, going to university, and you realised, you know, I'd love to get into that side of work?
Yeah, I mean, it was basically as soon as I realised that I was never going to make it as a professional footballer, I needed something else. And I thought, you know, what's the second best thing to playing? And I thought, well, if I can get paid to watch it, then that would be the next best thing. So that was essentially how it started. I've always been a big fan of radio. That's where I started out. And I did work experience when I was 14. I've always been very grateful to Tom Ross, Midlands broadcaster in the Midlands. He gave me my first work experience at the RMB. And then it was off the back of that, really, that I used to go in every Saturday afternoon at the RMB. I think it's now Free Radio in Birmingham. And I used to answer the phones for the phone in on a Saturday afternoon. I used to sit there with another guy called Ian Powell. You know, Ian Danter was commentating there, Mark Regan, you know, some really familiar names to some of the listeners and viewers, hopefully. And that was where I started, really. And it was being surrounded by all those people that brought me my passion, really, for broadcasting. And that's where it came from. And I thought, well, you know, I need to follow this path. And then following that path through school and then into broadcast journalism at university, did that for 3 years, came out and actually started in news. So freelanced around a bit in news for, again, BRNB, Heart, Galaxy, which I think might be Capital now, and ended up getting a job at an old radio station. All these radio stations have changed their names now. Touch FM, which used to cover Coventry and Warwickshire, a bit of Staffordshire, Oxfordshire. I think that's now Capital as well. So started out there working in news, but always they didn't actually have anyone at that radio station to cover sport for us. So I thought, great, this is my niche. So I used to go and cover Coventry City there, which my dad was very pleased about. That was during the Chris Coleman years at Coventry, and then used to go and cover non-league football as well. Used to go and watch Leamington in non-league as well. So that was where it started. My main job was in news, and then a job came up at Sky in Leeds, which I went for. It was Sky were launching a radio station, or it was more a testing out of a radio station, just to dip their toes in the water, just to see whether there would be much uptake on it. So I used to work up at, it was called Sky Sports News Radio up in Leeds. Worked there for 4 years, and then ended up moving to London to work for Sky Sports News. And that's kind of been the career path in a shorter time as possible.
So you think you've been with Sky 10 years now, is it?
Yeah, it's about 10 years, yeah. Yeah, I had my 10-year anniversary early this year, believe it or not.
10 years. So you don't look old enough to have been with Sky.
Yeah, I'm older than I look. I'm not going to say, but I'm older than I look.
So obviously that must be, you know, being a football fan. I know obviously that was the kind of the dream, but being at work and watching and talking about football must be incredible.
It is. It's hard sometimes because you sit there and you're talking about it all day, you're watching it all day, and then there's games on in the evening, and sometimes, you know, you find yourself struggling to get up for watching, you know, Fulham against Burnley or something in the evening. But sometimes you've got to watch it, and it's like, oh God, you know, but just because you've been talking about it and everything all day. But no, it's great. There's a fantastic team at Sky Sports News who are, you know, some of the most dedicated people, you know, working long hours, doing lots of different shifts. And, you know, sometimes you take it for granted a little bit, and you have to take a bit of a step back just to realise where you've got to, and you know, the people that you're working with and everything. And yeah, it's a great place to work. It's hard, but there are some fantastic people there that make it worthwhile.
So what about your job and kind of being able to follow Aston Villa in terms of, so say, you know, pre-COVID, how often would you be able to get to Villa Park, obviously living in London and being busy with work? How often would you be able to get up there?
Yeah, it's been difficult, you know, really hard actually, maybe maximum 4 or 5 times, a handful of times a season I can get up to watch, just because of working on weekends, lots of different shift patterns. It's interesting because, you know, maybe 20 years ago, I maybe wouldn't have been able to do this podcast or anything like this because, you know, the job of journalist was very much seen as not to show any sort of allegiances, and you're not, you know, you're supposed to be impartial and everything like that. And to some extent, and for obvious reasons, it's still the same in Scotland for our bureau in Scotland. But I think now that football fans in particular are a lot more intelligent about what they're watching, about who's talking about it. You know, football fans have been empowered over the last 10 or 15 years to question what they're watching and to, you know, demand more of what they're watching on TV, which I think is why there's been a huge improvement in punditry and football like that. So whenever I do stuff on the TV, you know, you there is that professionalism and impartiality. And, you know, I covered Blues when they had their points deduction for the profitability and sustainability rules. And, you know, there were a few Blues fans that, you know, were questioning me doing that only on social media. But it's because, you know, I'm fairly open with, you know, who I support on social media. But
yeah,
there is no question of my impartiality whatsoever, because, and particularly around Midlands teams, actually, because, you know, with the connection I have to Coventry, and, you know, I really want all the Midlands teams to do well, because, you know, the Midlands is a great place for football, and it improves the area, it improves the region when all the teams are doing well. I'd love to see Birmingham in the Premier League. I'd love to see Coventry, you know, it's going to be a tough season for them, but I'd love to see them improve this year. So, yeah, it's hard when you're on air, but you always have that impartiality and that professionalism around it, and, you know, that's something that I've very rarely been questioned on in my support. But it's a different world, isn't it? Social media, and that's where I kind of feel a little bit freer to show who I support.
And that's good. Yeah, I see what you mean. It's a good point to make in terms of, back in the day when people would get questioned on being impartial, etc., and it's kind of good that, because in all fairness, you know, you're an Aston Villa fan, but it doesn't mean that you can't talk about Birmingham City whilst doing your job. It's a bit of a silly one for people to kind of mention that. What about whilst you're working and you are covering a game and Aston Villa are playing? Have you got your phone under the table and you're trying to check the scores?
I mean, yes. Yes, I have. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And sometimes, you know, even when I'm in the office, there's been, you know, quite a few occasions where I think it was more in the year we were coming up from the Championship, where there were some just ridiculous games. You know, I think Rotherham away sticks in my mind, and I was in the office for that game, and I was, you know, hiding behind the chair, you know, screaming the players down. And, you know, if you watch Sky Sports News, it's an open air, open plan office. So literally, you know, the studio is over your right shoulder over there, and you're sat about 10 metres behind. So every, you know, little cheer is picked up, and, you know, the floor manager comes over and says, guys, you've got to keep quiet here. You get a bit told off sometimes. But yeah, it's there is no doubt that I am keeping up to date, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I work for the police, and years ago when I'd be working weekends, I'd be on the beat and Villa would be playing, and I'd try and find the kind of closest establishment that was showing the game to go and try and watch it on the side. And my excuse would be, yeah, I'm just, you know, making sure everyone's okay and kind of keep my eye on the Villa game, stuff like that. But that's football for you, isn't it? You kind of can't not watch it. What I'm gonna do to end is I'm gonna throw some quick fire questions at you.
Oh wow.
What we usually do is we'll kind of do this with when we've done this with ex-pros and kind of players and stuff like that. I've kind of tried to change it slightly to incorporate your career. So,
okay.
But obviously, if you can't answer any of them, then that's totally fine. There'll be some questions in there about Aston Villa, some about your job and stuff like that. So start with Aston Villa one. Favourite player of all time, Aston Villa?
Paul Merson, but it's getting close with Jack.
Yeah, I think to be fair, that's kind of most people's feelings at the moment, isn't it, really? It's like, Jack Grealish. What about your favourite manager?
John Gregory. Great personality.
Okay. Favourite person to work with at Sky Sports?
Ooh, that is a good one. Dharmesh Sheth, one of the reporters, transfer reporter. Yeah. Brilliant guy.
Lovely. What about kind of favourite guest that you may have spoke to at Sky Sports?
I mean, there's been some great names. You know, probably Tony Pulis might sound a bit odd, but he is just a great interviewee. He's one of those managers that keeps you on your toes in every press conference. You're not sure what he's going to say. Sometimes he won't even let you finish your question before he's answering something that you weren't even going to ask him about. So, you know, if it goes to favourite manager press conferences, Tony Pulis is right up there.
Lovely, lovely. There you go. favourite ever Aston Villa goal?
Ooh. Favourite Aston Villa goal? Probably, we mentioned it earlier, in the Leeds FA Cup game, Benito Carboni. Yes. The one the one from range. That was a brilliant goal.
Yeah, love that goal. Bringing it to this season, favourite signing of the season for us?
Oh, well, it's close between a couple of them, really. I am going to say Ross Barkley. Do you need a reason, or do you want me to expand? Or it's supposed to be quick fire. I'm rambling on.
Supposed to be quick fire. It happens every time because someone will say something and then I'll be like, oh, and then I'll ask a bit more about it. But yeah, Ross Barkley's up there with me, to be honest. Sometimes if someone asks me the question, I'll struggle with that one. But yeah, Ross Barkley, I don't think you need to expand on it. He's been brilliant, especially the last game. He was fantastic.
Yeah.
Favourite Sky Sports news studio moment that you've
been? Yeah, Steve McLaren in the European Championships against Iceland, and he's talking about how excited he was going to get for England getting into the game, and then and then Iceland scored. That was brilliant. That was one of the great moments that I was in there for. On air, I think that, you know, very recently I was on air when Gareth Bale was on his plane from Real Madrid to North London for Tottenham, and it was just a great moment following his flight, getting those first arrival pictures of him at the Tottenham training ground with all the fans outside. It was one of the great transfer window moments this summer.
Lovely. And last one, where do you think we'll finish this season?
Don't know whether to be optimistic or realistic. I'm quite a realist, so I'm going to say 12th.
Yeah, 12th's been my kind of prediction, which I think is a bit of... It is realistic, but at the same time, I feel like slightly optimistic, but it's one of them that, with the start, could easily be there.
It's the issue with injuries, isn't it? You're concerned, isn't it? You know, I think Dean's used the fewest number of players this season of anyone in the Premier League. He seems a little bit reluctant to look to his bench at the moment, and maybe that's because of a lack of options. So it'd be interesting if there are any injuries as to how Villa cope with that.
Yeah, certainly. I think that played a big part on us last season when we kind of lost our spine at times, didn't we? With Heaton, Mings was injured for a bit of time, John McGinn and Wesley, you know, Heaton, McGinn, Wesley, long-term injuries. And I think that played a key part. But yeah, lovely, fantastic. Massive, massive thank you for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to get you on our podcast.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me.
Nice one. So, yeah, thank you very much. David Reid from Sky Sports. Obviously, you guys are about to watch it on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts and everything else. Thank you very much from me. I'm Chris Ellis and we've been Villa Together. Thank you.